From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the horned woman, the windbag man, the giant colon, and the original Siamese twins. We talk with Gretchen Worden, director of the Mutter Museum, a medical museum that documents deformed and disfigured bodies and the impact of destructive diseases and trauma. She says while these bodies may be ugly, there is a terrifying beauty in the spirits of those forced to endure these afflictions. Also, Tony Award-winning actress Mary Louise Parker. She's currently starring in the film Red Dragon, and she's in the TV show The West Wing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The first polls in the nation's midterm elections are closing at this hour, and voters will decide at least one close and crucial seat in the Senate, Georgia. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
In recent days, it's been a close race between the Democratic incumbent, Max Cleland, and his Republican opponent, Saxby Chambliss, who currently serves in the House. The issues? National security and abortion. Chambliss has been running campaign ads featuring Osama bin Laden and suggesting Cleland is not supporting President Bush's homeland defense strategy and his policy on Iraq. Cleland, a veteran who lost both legs and an arm in Vietnam, has said that Chambliss is too conservative, particularly on issues such as abortion. Polls close in five other states this hour: Indiana, Kentucky, South Carolina, Vermont, and Virginia. These races are not considered particularly close. In Virginia, Republican Senator John Warner is not even facing a Democratic opponent. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News, Washington.
Media projections about the results of this election are expected to be slow and cautious after the nation's largest exit polling service said it would not be able to provide reliable data. Voter News Service said it was unable to correct problems with its exit polling system, especially the part that provides information about people's views on specific issues and the voting patterns of certain groups. Voter News Service is a consortium that was assembled by the major networks and news services in an effort to provide more reliable and detailed exit polling information. The polls are open in New Jersey for another hour. The two candidates in New Jersey's Senate race cast their ballots this morning. Gene Dillard reports.
Doug Forrester's campaign bus pulled up outside the polling place in his hometown of West Windsor before 7 this morning. Surrounded by television cameras, the Republican candidate and his family walked inside and cast their ballots. A half hour later, at a school in Cliffside Park, Democrat Frank Lautenberg took his turn in the booth, joking before he went in about which candidate he would vote for. Lautenberg is considered the front runner in the race, but Forrester is still predicting victory.
It's a wonderful day, beautiful day for voting.
The two men have only been campaigning against each other for a month. Forrester's first Democratic opponent, Robert Torricelli, pulled out of the race in the midst of an ethics scandal. He was replaced by Lautenberg in a controversial ballot switch. For NPR News, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
President Bush has returned to the White House to await the election returns. The president cast his own vote this morning in Crawford, Texas, after an intense last-minute campaign on behalf of GOP candidates. He spent the past 5 days campaigning in states where Republicans hope to hang on to or gain seats in the House, Senate, and governor's mansions. In stocks today, the Dow gained 106 points to close at 8,678 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 4 points. It closed at 1,401. This is NPR News. The Securities and Exchange Commission has added a new charge to its civil fraud case against WorldCom. The SEC alleges that the bankrupt telecom inflated its profits by more than $9 billion and said it had been misleading investors since as early as 1999. WorldCom, which is trying to settle the charges, acknowledged that its accounting restatement could go as high as $9 billion and said the restatement would have no impact on its ability to provide service or to emerge from bankruptcy protection in the middle of next year. The U.S. plans to circulate a revised version of a new U.N. Security Council resolution on Iraq, perhaps as early as tomorrow. U.N. diplomats say it's possible the proposal could come to a vote before the end of the week. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
Diplomats and U.S. officials are cautiously optimistic that the latest version of the resolution will resolve a standoff between the United States and other Security Council members. Kofi Annan, the U.N. Secretary General, offered this assessment in an interview to be broadcast Thursday on NPR's Tavis Smiley Show.
I suspect by the end of this week we will see a resolution that will command quite a large majority of the member states.
State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says the U.S. has altered the language to meet objections, primarily from France, Russia, and China, which have veto power on the Council. The main objection concerned language threatening the use of force if Iraq does not comply with U.N. demands to disarm. Boucher says the parties now are closer to a resolution that can gain broad support. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 7 points to close at 915. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida and the Tampa Bay Partnership for Regional Economic Development. Tampa Bay, the climate is right for business. On the web at tampabay.us.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Mutter Museum is a medical museum affiliated with the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Its exhibits are of tumors, lesions, spinal malformations, Siamese twins, and other deformities, pathologies, and medical anomalies. Although it was created for medical students, it's also open to the public and attracts many people who are interested in observing the mysteries of the human body. My guest, Gretchen Worden, has worked at the museum since 1975 and has directed it since 1988. She's compiled a new book of photos of the exhibitions. Many of the photographs were taken by artists who, Worden says, are not interested in conventional beauty, but want to explore its opposite, the deformed, the broken, the disfigured body of those who suffered congenital abnormality, trauma, or destructive disease. She adds, while these bodies may be ugly, there is a terrifying beauty in the spirits of those forced to endure these afflictions. I asked Worden to explain the original reason the Mutter Museum collected these medical anomalies.
It began as a museum of pathological anatomy, and it was based on the collections of Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter, who was a professor of surgery at Jefferson Medical College here in Philadelphia, 1841 to 56. And at that time, it was the way you taught medicine from actual specimens and models. And so its primary purpose was for the education of medical students.
So it wasn't uncommon then to collect and preserve diseased organs or to make plaster casts of deformities?
Oh, absolutely not. No, the idea of preserving both normal anatomical bodies and pathological specimens goes back hundreds of years before that.
I guess there weren't really good photographs yet?
Photographs didn't come along until 1839. That was when the first daguerreotype was produced. And so it was much more practical at that time if you wanted the teaching specimen to either preserve it in fluid or dry it out or reproduce it as a wax model or a plaster cast.
Now, why are they exhibited now? These aren't used to teach anymore, right?
Oh, we're still very educational. Only the audience has changed.
Right.
We're part of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, which is a private medical society that was founded in 1787. And it has a tremendous medical historical library, the fourth largest in the country. And the museum collection was seen as a complement to the information in the library for the benefit primarily, when it was acquired by the college, of the members of the college and their professional colleagues. But the public was always welcomed ever since it became part of the college in 1863. And it simply is a fact that today most of our visitors are from the general lay public, not people with medical backgrounds. But they're seeing the same materials that were collected and used to educate physicians in a previous century.
I want to talk about some of the specimens that are in the Mutter Museum. And let's start with a plaster cast of a French woman's head with a horn growing out of the forehead. Who is this person and what's happened to her head?
Actually, it's a wax model. The woman, as far as we know, was known as Madame Dimanche, which has been translated as the Widow Sunday. And she was an 80-year-old washerwoman living in Paris. And she'd actually had some previous growths of this type. It's called cornucutaneum. It's a horny substance in the skin that starts overgrowing and producing these excrescences. And in this case, it happened to be a spectacular growth coming out of her forehead. And the model that we have shows it about 6 inches long. The reports, there's a published report in an 1851 journal that describes it as being, by that time, 9 or 10 inches long. And she had to support it in a sack sewn onto her nightcap until she finally got to the doctor and had it taken off.
How do you live with a horn growing out of your forehead for so long?
Well, I keep telling people, even today, people put off going to the doctor. And I think we all have a little reluctance. Back then, there was less that a doctor could do for you, so the hesitation was natural. That's one of the biggest questions. People look at her and wonder, how can you let it grow so long? And I point out that she was a washerwoman, and this is someone who takes in laundry. She probably was not dealing with the public. She was a widow, didn't have a husband around to nag her about getting that thing off your forehead. So I'm just speculating, but that's what she did.
Now, is this a problem that still exists? I mean, are people still growing horns out of their foreheads?
Absolutely. Anybody can develop this, and it can be found in animals as well, cats and dogs. But as I say, it doesn't usually get that large.
Now, there's a plaster cast of Chang and Eng, the original Siamese twins.
Right.
How did the Motor Museum get a plaster cast of the Siamese twins?
We had it made. And we had it made because we had just completed the autopsy on the Siamese twins in 1874. And that really was a great moment in the history of the college. These were internationally known men. And the question had always persisted from the first time they started going on public exhibit in 1829. Could they have been safely separated? And they would challenge the medical profession with that question. And it was a way of getting publicity. And finally, when the College of Physicians heard that they died, they realized this was an opportunity to answer that question. And they actually were able to get the families to agree to have the bodies brought to Philadelphia, and the autopsy was done in the Mutter Museum at its original location at 13th and Locust Streets. And after it was completed, that was when we had the cast made. We were allowed to keep their actual livers as well, because those were the only organs that were connected through that band.
So are their livers still on exhibit?
Absolutely, right below the cast.
And how are they preserved?
They're preserved right now in a 75% alcohol solution.
Huh. So Chang and Eng were joined by the abdomen.
It was actually at the end of the breastbone, there's a cartilage, and they were connected by that cartilage. So the band mostly consisted of skin and cartilage with superficial circulatory connections going along the very thin strip of liver tissue that actually passed through that band.
How did they die, and what did the Mutter Museum autopsy discover about whether they could have lived independent of each other?
They died because a few years before, 1874, Chang had suffered a stroke, and he was not in as good health as Eng, who was the larger, taller twin. And so it came to one night in January of 1874 when he was having trouble breathing and was obviously ill. But they had this routine. They had married sisters in North Carolina and had families of 21 children, but they set up separate households in adjacent farms, and every 3 days, like clockwork, they would travel from one man's farm to the other so that each man could be with his family, be the master of his estate, and then they would go. So it was a dark and stormy night, and they probably should not have gone because Chang was not well, but he insisted that they go to Ang's house. And during the night, he died. And Eng woke up and found that his brother was dead and roused the household, and they sent for the doctor, who had always said, if one dies, I will cut close to the body of the dead twin and the other one should be able to survive. The doctor didn't come in time. And over the space of a few hours, Eng lapsed into a coma and died.
So did the autopsy find that they perhaps could have survived had they been separated earlier?
There is always that speculation that had it been done when they were children, when you have greater recuperative powers, it might have been successful. But they also discovered that in that band, unsuspected,
the band of muscle that joined them?
The band of skin and cartilage, yeah. Mm-hmm. There were slight outpouchings from each man's peritoneal cavity that contains their abdominal organs. So the band would have had to be very carefully dissected, because if you get into the peritoneum, then you can get massive abdominal infection. So the risk of infection was always there. And, of course, you're talking 1874. We're just beginning to use antiseptic surgical procedures. It's 20 years before x-rays. You really couldn't get an idea ahead of time what you'd find. It would have been just operating blind, so to speak. So the conclusion was that in the best of cases, they might have been surgically separated, but it probably would not have been advisable at any point because of the risk of shock and infection, and certainly more so when they were adult men.
Gretchen Worden is my guest, and she directs the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. It's a museum of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, and it was created in the 19th century as a museum of medical anomalies to teach medical students about the practice of medicine. And right now it's open to the public, and it's just very, very popular place to see all kinds of medical mysteries. One of the things on exhibit at the Mutter Museum is a giant colon, a colon that grew to approximately five times the size of an average colon. What is the story behind this colon?
It belonged to a man who died in 1892 at age 29, and it's a congenital condition where you have a problem with the nerve supply to the muscular wall of the colon, so feces don't pass through normally. And you get backup of feces, and that's what caused the enlargement of the colon. Today we'd probably solve it by a colostomy or resection of the bowel, and they'd pick it up soon after, but we're talking the late 19th century. So it just got progressively larger as he grew, because at first he was able to function. He had various jobs as a messenger, and at one time he was actually on display at the famous Dime Museum at 9th and Arch Street as the windbag or balloon man. But as he got older, he was getting increasingly uncomfortable. So in 1892, we went to Hahnemann Medical College and complained to the doctors, and they correctly diagnosed it as enlarged colon, but 1892, you weren't doing abdominal surgery that could have helped him in any way. So they took photographs, which we have on display at the museum with the colon, and then had to just send him away, and he died a few months later.
What did he look like?
He looked like a perfectly ordinary guy, about 5'7", a spare body, but with this enormously distended abdomen. And when they did the autopsy, they found that his abdominal organs were practically, you know, pushed up into his chest, up to his clavicle. So it must have been horribly uncomfortable.
So this colon is now preserved in what?
It was cleaned out, dried, and stuffed with a lot of Excelsior, which is just wood shavings. We found old newspapers in it. I mean, it was a big thing to stuff. So they put in a lot of material. And it's important now because it's a spectacular example. Megacolons are fairly rare, and they just rarely get to that size. So it is still impressive, even from gastroenterologists today. And it makes it very clear how far medicine has progressed since 1892.
My guest is Gretchen Worden, director of the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. Her new book is called Mutter Museum. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gretchen Worden, director of the Mutter Museum, which is part of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. The museum was started in the mid-19th century to teach medical students about deformities, disfigurements, and the effects of destructive diseases. Now, the Mutter Museum was in its planning stages during the Civil War, and it actually opened at just about the time that the Civil War ended. Mm-hmm. And there are several very interesting displays within the exhibit that are documented in your new book of Civil War injuries, of medical instruments that were used to treat mm-hmm. soldiers during the Civil War. Let's talk about some of that a little bit. First of all, there were a lot of amputations during the war. How is that documented? Amputations of soldiers who needed, you know, had gangrene limbs or other wounds that required the limb be removed. What kind of documentation do you have of that in the museum?
The photographs you mentioned actually came from the Surgeon General's office. It's part of what they call the photographic series, and that was documenting Civil War wounds from about 1865 until about 1881. It's a magnificent photo document of the Civil War. And what they were able to do was, in some cases, document the initial operation, what the men looked like. And then as some of these soldiers would return to Washington to discuss pension disputes, for instance, they would be asked to go back to the Army Medical Museum where the photos had been taken, and you could do follow-ups. So you can actually see what procedures were successful and how well the men did as a result of amputations and some of the other operations. There's an idea that an awful lot or that too many operations, amputations, were done during the Civil War, but in some cases the doctors have said that there weren't enough, because when you have a really severely damaged limb that is infected by the dirt, the clothing and whatnot, infection could kill the man. So the best thing to do is to remove the limb, create a clean surgical wound that will then heal naturally. And some doctors didn't want to amputate, would defer the decision from the field hospital to the general hospital. So by the time the guy had his amputation, it was sometimes too late. An infection had set in and they would die. So it was done, for the most part, appropriately.
And needless to say, this is before antibiotics. So
exactly.
You couldn't kill an infection with antibiotics then.
Yeah.
Well, you also have on display a Civil War medical kit. Talk about some of the instruments in that kit that we wouldn't see today.
Actually, you'd see most of them today. The only thing you wouldn't see is instruments with ebony handles, because now we know about sterilization. And to do either heat or chemical sterilization, you need an all-steel instrument. But the shape of the knives, the trephins, are almost exactly what you'll find in a modern amputating kit. And I've been told by some surgical departments that they still keep a case like this handy for use in amputations.
There's a little saw in there?
Yep, there's a saw. There's a saw for the skull. There's a saw for taking off big limbs. And a metacarpal saw for taking off fingers and toes.
Is that how it would be done today, with a saw like that?
They would probably use an electric saw. Not the old back-and-forth type.
Right.
But otherwise, yeah, sawing is the way you get through bone.
Was there any equivalent of anesthesia besides, you know, a good shot of alcohol?
Oh, absolutely. No. See, this is the other point that people forget about the Civil War. Anesthesia, ether, and chloroform had both been in use since the 1840s. By the time the Civil War came along, doctors were well experienced in using it. And they, for the most part, had good supplies all through the war. And so anesthesia was not a problem. They did have that.
What are some of the things that were learned about medicine as a result of treating all the war injuries?
A lot of the doctors did become more proficient in dealing with trauma wounds, because a lot of these doctors are coming from private practice where you did not see as many gunshot wounds and fractures. So they improve their skills that way. There were advances made in plastic surgery, particularly because of a New York doctor, Dr. Gurdon Buck, who had a lot to work with in terms of some pretty awful face wounds, and made improvements there. The problem with the Civil War is it came just before the great breakthrough of Pasteur with the germ theory and Lister with the antisepsis. And so Whereas in a lot of wars, you can look at all of the great leaps forward that have been made that then become part of the systematic practice of medicine. With the Civil War, it's not so much that case. The great advance there was in the organizing of the Army Medical Corps and in evacuating wounded men from the field very quickly and getting them to field hospitals, because wars always catch the Army Medical Corps by surprise. And so they have to staff up very quickly by getting a lot of contract surgeons and enlisting men, and also having to set up a system of the hospitals and the ambulances. So that was the great advance, really, medically in the Civil War.
Gretchen Worden is my guest. She's the longtime director of the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. It's a museum of medical anomalies that was created in the mid-1800s. It's part of the Philadelphia College of Physicians. And now there's a new book called Mutter Museum, in which there's a lot of photographs of the exhibits there and a lot of interesting explanations of them. It was put together by Gretchen Worden. You say in the book that one of the most popular exhibits in the museum is a collection of more than 2,000 objects removed from the throats and airways of patients, such as? What are some of the things that have been removed from patients' throats?
Well, the collection came to us in 1924. So there's stuff in there that you're not going to see around today. Collar buttons, for example, very popular with kids. We also have a lot of hairpins and safety pins. And I speculate that, you know, maybe it was a mother holding the pin as she's diapering the baby. Today you'd have diaper tabs. That's a current choking hazard. You also get a lot of toys you don't see. Jacks. I don't know if kids play with jacks anymore, but they certainly aren't using skate keys. And those are some of the items. Plus, there's a lot of dental appliances. I think dentists are more careful now about removing loose prosthetics from the mouth before they go in. But there's a lot of that slipped down people's throats.
There's a really eerie image in there. I think it must be like an x-ray or something, of a throat with a little toy battleship stuck in it.
Yeah, it's an x-ray of a child, and we have the little metal battleship, and it was successfully removed. Dr. Chevalier Jackson was the physician who assembled the collection, and it was to be used as a teaching collection because for each item, he has the complete case history, how old the patient was, where the object was, what it was, how long it had been in there, and what instrument was used to successfully remove it.
Gretchen Worden is the director of the Mutter Museum of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Her new book is called Mutter Museum. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, committed to serving Lutherans, their families, and communities with financial strategies and customer-focused service, online at thrivent.com. And by DK Publishing, publisher of Bill Wyman's Rolling with the Stones, the inside story of the rock and roll band told by a man who can tell it like it was. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Gretchen Worden, director of the Mutter Museum, and we meet actress Mary Louise Parker. She won a Tony for her performance on Broadway in Proof. She's now in the film Red Dragon and the TV show The West Wing.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Gretchen Worden, director of the Mutter Museum of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. The museum was created in the 1860s as a teaching museum for doctors studying deformed and disfigured bodies and the impact of destructive diseases and trauma. Its collection includes wax models, photographs, and actual specimens. Worden has a new book that features photos of the Mutter Museum's collection. The Mutter Museum has a whole collection of fetuses stored in jars. What are some of the medical reasons for this collection?
Well, it's interesting. We just have redone that exhibit. It's called our teratology collection, and it's congenital abnormalities or birth defects. And it's important in the study of embryology and in the study of how the body develops normally. Oftentimes, it's only when something goes wrong that you're aware of how it should go right and at what point in the development. So it's a document of all the different things that can affect the development of the child. And it can be the internal environment. It can be things that the mother has ingested or is exposed to. It can be genetic. It can simply be a mutation in a gene. It can be caused by any number of environmental teratogens, and I think there are more of those today that can cause deformities. So it really gives us insight into the way human beings develop when you look at the anomalies.
And are most of these fetuses, were they mostly delivered or taken surgically from the mother's womb?
The older specimens would probably be either natural miscarriages or have been delivered normally. The more recent ones that we have with the severe anomalies are sometimes from pregnancies that have been terminated deliberately because the defect has been picked up on ultrasound or amniocentesis, and the decision was made not to carry the pregnancy further.
Is this one of the exhibits that gets, like, the most emotional reaction from people? Or I'm wondering if it's even controversial among some people.
It really, surprisingly, hasn't engendered any controversy because we have it within the context of the whole Mutter Museum. We're an educational museum about medicine and human development. It's in a section where it segues smoothly into normal fetal development, conjoined twins. So because of that, people look at it as part of the whole display, which is why I don't sometimes like to have photographs of the fetuses taken and set apart from the rest of the environment. But people, of course, they're amazed sometimes to see some of these defects, and then they start reading the labels. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with all of the museum. Now, I get sometimes people react more strongly to the megacolon. Or to the swallowed objects. You never know what someone's going to identify with. They either have had a similar problem or they know someone with it. Some people can't get over that human horn.
Right. You know, one of the things that knocks me out, there's a couple of photographs that you've included in your Mutter Museum book of two women with lordosis, which is a severe curvature of the spine. And you know, like the trunk of their body is about 3 inches in front of the rear of their body, and the waist is just kind of flat, like flat and extended.
Yeah.
So like the behind is on one end of the waist, and then several inches in front of it is the torso. It's like there's a flat thing connecting them. I'm not sure if I'm describing this very clearly.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of thing where you look at it and you could say, that's how I feel some days. You know?
Well, that's the way I feel about the megacolon.
Right.
Yeah. I'm feeling bloaty.
Is that a typical reaction that people that personally relate to some of these anomalies? Because even though these anomalies are just very extreme disfigurements, that you kind of feel that way on a smaller level sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. As I say, it's you are struck by the fact that you're looking at human beings. And there, but for the grace of God, go I, you say oftentimes. And thank God for modern medicine.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's And, of course, the fact is a lot of what we look at in the museum and think, oh, my God, nobody has that today. All you have to do is go into a third world country or go into rural America and you will find these, you know, incredibly disfiguring disorders. We are so spoiled by the fact that we're living in a city that has been a center of medicine since the 18th century, and we've got the best here. But that's not the way the rest of the world lives.
What's one of the exhibits that we haven't yet mentioned that gets a very strong response from viewers?
I think that would be the Wall of Skulls. That is visually one of the most striking images in the museum, which is why we chose to put it on the jacket cover of the book. And that image is the same one that we used in the first Mutter Museum calendar in 1993. It's a collection of 139 skulls from the peoples of Eastern and Central Europe that we bought from a Viennese anatomist in 1874. And this type of collection was typical of 19th century medical museums. They would collect skulls of people from all over the world, and thousands of them, and have them on display, because the whole idea is compare and contrast, be able to look at all of the differences between the skulls, which you can only see when you see a large number together. And what's fascinating is that Professor Hurdle, from whom we bought it, was able to record, in most cases, the name, the age, the occupation, in some cases a religion, and the cause of death of each of these individuals. So you're not just looking at a skull for the shape, as an anthropologist would. You're looking in a life, and you're seeing just a little glimpse of what people were living like in mid-19th century Europe. You've got your guerrillas, you've got your deserters, your soldiers, you know, who, from one hand, they're bad people. On the other hand, they're freedom fighters. It all depends on which side you were of the politics. There's a mother who killed her child. There's a rope walker who died of a broken neck. It's wonderful from a sociological and cultural point of view. So you have this wall of skulls with this very cursory information, and you can look at it and just kind of imagine, if they had to summarize my life in four lines and write it on the side of my skull, what would they write? And we get that kind of reaction from people, too.
Now, the Mutter Museum's collection of medical anomalies and deformities dates back to a time that precedes good photography and precedes imaging, certainly. Mm-hmm. Now that we have photography and we have imaging, are there new specimens that you're getting, or is that not done anymore?
Oh, no, we're still getting new specimens. We haven't gotten a recent congenital abnormality that has been born recently, but I just did get a collection from an individual who had been collecting them over the years and who wanted to donate the collection to a museum. So we do get new specimens. Mostly what we get now, though, are instruments.
There's so many different ways to relate to the Mutter Museum. One way is that, you know, it's fascinating medical history. It's a good teaching mm-hmm. tool for doctors. Another is that it's just a kind of oddly beautiful representation of the human condition, all the things that mm-hmm. could go astray with the physical part of the human condition. But another way of looking at it is it's just good gross out fun, right? And I'm sure a lot of people come to the Mutter Museum for that reason, that it's good gross out kind of fun. How do you react when people come to the museum for that reason? To point and to laugh and giggle and...
Well, I'll tell you, they may be drawn there out of curiosity.
Uh-huh.
Curiosity is a wonderful motivator. And possibly the curiosity is a little morbid. But once they walk into that space, they see the beautiful wooden cabinets and the rich colors of the carpet and the lighting, and then they start reading the labels and they're immediately sucked into the whole life of that individual and how it reflects back on your life. So you don't get a lot of poking and laughing. You'll get some comments like, hey, come over here, look at this. You won't believe it. But that's great. I mean, because it's wonderful to hear the interactions of people between themselves looking at these things and just quietly interacting with the specimen itself. So whatever gets people in the door is fine, and curiosity brought me in that door.
Yeah?
25 or 27
what was
years
it that
ago.
Brought you in?
Well, actually, the I happened to go to church next door from the time I was 8 years old. I had no idea what was in that building until I was going to Temple University studying anthropology and still singing in the church choir. And the guy who sang bass happened to be assistant to the curator at the museum, and he told me about it. He took me over to see the museum, and I said, if you ever leave this job, I want it. He left, I got it. So it was fascinating because when I was growing up in the Philadelphia area, you always heard about the museum that had babies in bottles. And you had to be a medical student to be able to see them, which, of course, was not true. And then to find out I've been going to church next door to that museum. It was fabulous.
Now, I understand you keep up with the tabloids to see what kind of medical anomalies, real and imagined, they are documenting. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That's where you find most of the stories about Siamese twins, the real ones and the fake ones. And they have stringers all over the world. So sometimes you see something reported in a tabloid before it even hits the medical literature. And it also is a way of seeing how the public looks at these anomalies and the stuff that they will believe because they don't know any better. You know, Siamese triplets. I'm sorry. We will explain to you very carefully in our exhibits how Siamese triplets just don't happen.
Why not?
But, well, it's because it's a single egg that splits in two, and it can't split again in three. Now, maybe you have some fusion going on, but no, you have to read the tabs with a little discretion. But see, that, again, points up an area where we can help to inform the public.
Well, Gretchen Worden, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Gretchen Worden is the director of the Mutter Museum of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Her new book is called Mutter Museum. Coming up, actress Mary Louise Parker. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Mary Louise Parker, is now starring opposite Edward Norton in the movie Red Dragon, and she plays feminist political consultant Amy Gardner on the TV show The West Wing. She joined the cast last season and was nominated for an Emmy. She's earned many awards for her stage work, including a Tony for her performance in Proof and an Obie for her performance in How I Learned to Drive. Her movies include Fried Green Tomatoes, Naked in New York, Bullets Over Broadway, and The Five Senses. Let's start with her first scene on The West Wing, where Josh Lyman, Deputy White House Chief of Staff, came to see her in her office. At the time, her character was the head of a feminist lobby group. One of the people she was trying to influence was the First Lady.
You know, every time you write a letter to the First Lady, she gets into gear because she feels guilty that she's not doing enough for women.
She's not doing enough for women.
What would you like?
I'm glad you asked.
Not half as glad as I am.
The current draft of the document says only forced prostitution and not other types of prostitution is sexual exploitation.
Yes.
What about someone who answers an ad for an au pair and ends up working a 15-hour shift in a whorehouse where they're held hostage and can never pay off their debt?
Yeah.
That's not the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario was 5 days ago when four 13-year-old Thai girls were found having hanged themselves in an abandoned house in Stonycrest Lane in Bethesda.
Yeah.
Not halfway around the world, Bethesda. There were sheets over the windows, triple locks on the doors, no phones, handcuffs hanging off the bedposts. For the price of a four-slice toaster, their parents had sold them to work as babysitters.
How is that not forced prostitution?
I've got a whole floor full of lawyers who, in the last 2 years, 100,000 women, and by women, I'm including girls who should be playing with easy bake ovens, 100,000 in the last 2 years were brought here and forced to work as prostitutes. You know how many of these cases we've prosecuted?
Not enough.
250? You guys are about to go to Vienna and make it harder, so yeah, I dropped the First Lady a note.
Mary Louise Parker, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I'm thinking about your part on The West Wing. Don't we all wish we could talk with such well-written sentences, like everyone's dialogue on The West Wing?
I do. I do. It's not going to happen for me in this life, though.
Why don't you describe that first scene that he wrote for you?
Well, the first scene introduces the character, and it it brings Josh into her world, which is the world. She's a feminist lobbyist, and he comes to visit her at her office. And he pretty much steps right into her world. He makes reference to there's a lot of art on the walls. It's feminist art that's, like, terrifying to him. And it's just this world that's he's not a part of, that that also wasn't really on the show so much, that is kind of welcomed on the show. I think it's a really good thing to have represented, this feminist perspective. And so Josh comes into that world, and we sort of meet there. And, you know, I guess it's so corny, but it's some kind of chemistry thing. They are so different, and she is so strong. She's so direct, and I think he really responds to that. And she's so passionate about what she believes in the same way that he is. And I think that people are attracted to that in someone else when they're very passionate.
Now, you've said that you're very shy offstage and you're most at ease when you're acting. What is the liberty of being on stage or of being in character?
I don't know. And I don't even know if shy is the right word for it. I'm not the most revealing person necessarily. I just don't feel that on stage. I just don't feel that at all. I feel free to communicate, and I feel like I can communicate, and it's just not something I feel in life. It's a struggle for me, and I feel uncomfortable. I second guess myself, what I'm saying, what somebody's understanding, what they think I mean, what I think I mean. And I just don't feel that on stage. I mean, and I have moments on stage that are, you know, really unpleasant, or when I feel like it's not going well. But generally, in my life, the moments when I felt most understood and like I could truly communicate something, I was completely present on the planet, on the earth, were when I was in a play.
You said that you don't like to be revealing. I should say that moments before you walked into the studio, I found out that there are a few very revealing photos of you in this month's edition of Esquire, in which you've posed nude. And I'll confess I haven't seen the magazine yet or read the article that you wrote that accompanies the photos. But could you maybe talk about why you were comfortable, willing to do nude shots for Esquire magazine? Whatever possessed you?
Well, they asked me, I'd written something for Esquire last year, and they asked me if I wanted to write something again. I had all these things, and then the last one I said was, you know, or I could write about being naked in Esquire, and the guy said, oh, that's a good idea. Would you consider posing naked again? Like, all in one sentence, without a breath. And he's a really great guy, actually, and very intelligent, and, you know, but he works for a magazine, and I just thought, huh. Yeah. Okay. Well, are you going to get naked too? It just, you know.
Well,
was
did he get naked too?
Yeah.
What's the difference between being naked on stage and being naked as Mary Louise Parker in a magazine?
Well, for me as a person, if I weren't an actress, I have no discomfort posing naked. I just don't have any. I love photography. I love my problem comes with what it means for an actress to be naked, or what it means for a woman to be naked, which is something that I talk about in the article. And I, in the end, the way I kind of reconciled that within myself was, I thought, okay, well, anyone who can sort of suggest my nudity with any sense of largesse or comfort or whatever, maybe he'd like to know what it feels like himself, you know, because it's really easy for someone at a magazine to sit back and say, yeah, let's get a picture of that actress naked, you know? I mean, they do it all the time. Let's get her in a bikini. Let's airbrush her whatever. But you never see that person. You never see the person who comes up with that idea. That person is protected completely. And I just thought, well, you know, what does that person look like? And what does that person look like who's maybe judging my photo, who's saying, oh, well, I don't know, this isn't a very good picture of her thigh, or, you know, what does that person actually look like? It's like, you know, when you read something nasty about yourself or someone else in the newspaper or in a magazine, and they say, oh, what was she thinking when she put this skirt with this top? You know, you just, some part of me wants to see what that person had on when they wrote that statement.
So I guess I just find it interesting that for you, being naked is not revealing, but talking about your life is revealing in a way that makes you uncomfortable. Because for so many people, it's the other way around. They're happy to talk about themselves, more than happy, but would be very uncomfortable.
I find that really weird.
Do you?
I do. I find that really weird. I mean, this is just my body. This doesn't mean anything. This is going to be the first thing to go when I die. The rest of me, you know, my thoughts or my relationships or anything like that. I've never been someone who reveals things like that. I don't reveal a lot of those things to a lot of my friends. I just, I'm just not like that. And I don't know. It always surprises me when people are really comfortable with that, when people just are able to do that. There have been a few instances in my life. I have a friend who I met her, and I met her once, and then the second time I met her was on the set of a movie, and we stood on the sidewalk, and in about 20 minutes told each other, you know, our deepest secret, like the most important thing in our lives, and we're still friends, but that's so rare for me. It just is so rare, and when I do reveal, I always regret it. I always feel, I don't know, I always feel uncomfortable.
My guest is Mary Louise Parker. She's currently starring in Red Dragon, and she plays a feminist political consultant on The West Wing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Mary Louise Parker. She's currently starring in Red Dragon, and she plays a feminist political consultant on The West Wing. When we left off, she was describing how uncomfortable she is revealing personal things about herself. I'm wondering if you've ever been in psychotherapy where you're really reaching deep into your personal experiences, but you're telling them to a paid professional who is obliged to not reveal this stuff to anybody. So, you know, your secrets, your personal feelings should all be very safe with them.
It's not about safety, really. In this business, it's partly a rebellion thing as well. I don't understand why people reveal so much about themselves. And I feel like I don't have to, mm-hmm. and I shouldn't have to. And it has nothing to do with my work. And in a way, I feel like it impedes my work because, you know, sometimes I look at actresses and I think, why do I know what perfume that girl uses? Or how come I know the last five guys that she dated or what hotel she stays at? You know, I don't want people to think those things when they look at me acting. I don't want that for them. I think it gets in the way.
Gets in the way of seeing you in character?
Yeah, it gets in the way of telling the story, mm-hmm. you know? Aside from which, I just don't think it's anybody's business.
When you show up for an interview, whether it's for a stage or for a movie, do you show up as yourself, as Mary Louise Parker, or do you show up as the character?
I don't really know how to show up as anything except myself, and I feel like sometimes it behooves. I know this friend of mine was auditioning for this Calamity Jane, and she said, oh, you know, I went in, I wore chaps, and I had a holster and cowboy, and I thought, God, that's just, you know, that's great. I would never be able to do that, though. I thought, did she go down and get in a cab and her chaps and her, like, wasn't she embarrassed or, you know, and walking in, I just would feel like an idiot. People want to see when you walk in the room. They generally want to see the character. They don't necessarily want to see an actress who can play the character. They want to see that character. Not for stage, but for film, it's like that. So, and I don't generally come in the room like that, you know, and I'm not a type necessarily. So, but people get work that way, and I admire them for being able to do it without feeling like a moron, because I can't really.
Now, you're in the forthcoming HBO production of the play Angels in America. And also in this is Al Pacino, I think Meryl Streep.
Mm-hmm. Emma Thompson.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You said this is a role you really wanted to do. Why did you want to do it so much?
Oh, it's just so beautifully written. It's one of the greatest pieces of writing of our century, I think. It's poetic. It's hilarious. It's surprising. It's genius. And it's the kind of writing where you don't want to ruin a syllable. You want to adhere to every comma, every semicolon. You don't want to screw up a single preposition. It's like verse. It's like poetry. And the character herself is just, you know, I've loved that character ever since I read the play, you know, 12 years ago or however many years ago it was that I read it. I can't believe I got that part. I really still can't believe it.
Mary Louise Parker, she's now starring in Red Dragon, and she plays a feminist political consultant on the West Wing. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times foreign correspondent John Burns about his 3 weeks in Iraq last month. He was there during the election and the amnesty that freed tens of thousands of political prisoners and criminals. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.